failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies. Welcome to this edition of Century of Lies. You hear me say week after week after week that there is no one within government, law enforcement, the drug czar, nobody willing to come on our program and defend the policy of eternal drug war. Last month, the King County Bar Association sponsored the Exit Strategy for the War on Drugs conference up in Seattle. In the middle of this conference, Roger Goodman of the King County Bar, who helped hammer together this conference, introduced a group of panelists who were participating in the event for a press conference.
Just want to welcome you to this historic conference where we're moving beyond the mere criticism of the so-called war on drugs and beginning to fashion reasonable solutions. We have literally gathered experts from around the country and also from Europe and Canada to begin these deliberations. Perhaps I should introduce who is standing here. Steve Rawls is from the Transform Foundation in the United Kingdom, come out with a groundbreaking document on regulation instead of prohibition. Ethan Nadelman, standing to Steve's left, is the executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance in New York, the leading organization in the world in drug policy reform. Senator Pierre Nolan just gave the luncheon address and is a drug reform pioneer in Canada. Deborah Small is the head of what's called Break the Chains, and is, in my opinion, one of the most articulate and thoughtful spokespeople on drug policy reform. Freek Polak is from Amsterdam, is a psychiatrist, and also has a lot of knowledge on what's going on in the Netherlands and in Europe in general. Rick Steves is, some of you may know, a celebrated travel writer, lives here in the Seattle area, and also is very outspoken on drug policy reform, particularly regarding marijuana or cannabis. Norm Stamper is the former police chief of the city of Seattle and has been particularly outspoken on the need to end prohibition. Eric Sterling is the president of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation of the Washington, D.C., formerly counsel for the House Judiciary Committee. The drug laws were written on his computer, and he's been doing penance ever since. Peter Werder is, by many estimation, the recognized leading scholar in drug policy, and will be talking in the next panel. And he, along with Rob McCoon, have written what I consider the Bible called Drug War Heresies, which all of us are required to read. Mark Hayden from Vancouver, another pioneer who's really developed a terrific guide for us on different types of regulatory mechanisms that we need to put in place. To Jonathan Wender, a police veteran here from the Seattle area, also a PhD and a college instructor. David Courtright, behind Jonathan, is one of the two leading historians of the drug use and the war on drugs. And then San Hotri, from the Institute of Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., a recognized expert in the international aspects of the war on drugs. And we have further luminaries, Mike Gray, a Hollywood screenwriter, Academy Award nominee for The China Syndrome, and also the author of Drug Crazy. Any questions you have, anyone who wants to answer, just go ahead and start.
My name is Dean Becker. I'm with the Drug Truth Network, and I wonder why there are no representatives from the Drug Czar's office or other, you know, notables within government here in attendance.
First, to answer my question, was Canadian Senator Pierre-Claude Nolan.
Maybe I should say that I had an honest, intimate meeting with Mr. Walters in Ottawa while I was writing my report. For probably a diplomatic reason, they asked not to be cited to the word. But if one thing I can tell you, Mr. Walter, at the end of the dinner, where he had a few sips of wine, by the way, he was there with his staff, his important staff, and I was there with my researchers and some colleagues on the committee. At the end of the night, he said, "Senator, probably we will not be able to never agree to each other. I understand exactly what you want. For you, it's a health question. And for me, it's a moral question. Even in small quantity, it's morally wrong."
Ethan Nadelman, Drug Policy Alliance. We actually invited Walters and DEA head Tandy to the DPA conference in Long Beach, as we had invited McCaffrey in past years. So they either don't respond, or else they respond that they can't make it. In fact, it doesn't even come to the issue of they're suggesting that they send a lower-level person. That hasn't happened. There was some willingness in the McCaffrey days to engage quietly, although he would withdraw from, you know, televised debates and things if I or some others were on. But with respect to Walters, I mean, he's been adamant about refusing to engage in any direct dialogue, even on major television programs. He will routinely demand that it not be set up as a debate, that he be interviewed separately or what have you. So they don't want it.
Once again, Roger Goodman of the King County Bar.
I have to say that when we released our report, the King County Bar Association, in March of this year, the media called around, called the DEA and called the ONDCP, and their comment was officially no comment. I mean, they affirmatively said, we have no comment. I do want to contrast, however, the response of local law enforcement and local prosecutors who were very willing to engage with us and still, and more so, wanting to talk with us about pragmatic questions, and so we're reaching out and beginning to engage with them.
Steve Rolls from Transform Drug Policy Foundation in the UK. We're looking at how regulatory models will work. So the question isn't, can the war on drugs be won or can it be made to work? It's specifically what is beyond the war on drugs and how do we escape from it. And something else which I was interested to stumble across on the internet was that there's actually a DEA page, sort of set website specifically on how to argue against legalizing drugs, which I think is almost unique in government output, really, to actually not just put forward your position, but actually give people guidance on how to argue against the contrary position. So clearly those aren't people who are going to engage in any meaningful way, given that they've set their stall out very, very clearly.
Oh, Deborah Small, Break the Chains, based in New York. I just want to make the point that today around the country, people are marking the anniversary of the day that Rosa Parks refused to go to the back of the bus and triggered the beginning of the Montgomery bus boycott. And the reason that I refer to that is because I think that if you remember that event, at the time that people were demonstrating just for the right to be able to sit in the section of the bus that had been designated for them without interference, as they moved forward and came up against the recalcitrance of the people in power at the time, they realized that their demands were too small, and they began moving for what became an agenda around ending segregation completely. And at the time that those debates and conversations were being had, particularly the ones around school desegregation that started back in the 30s, that was considered to be as fringe a position to be taking, for black people to be taking at the time, as taking the position today about getting rid of drug prohibition. And so my belief, and I think what we all represent, is a vision of society beyond drug prohibition, understanding the impact, the negative impacts that it's having, and understanding that it's important to have people who are credible, who are respectable, who are well-thinking, to actually create this vision, to set forth a path for people to follow, and to understand that we may not be around to see the realization of our vision, but all of us have no doubt that it will come into being.
I'm Eric Sterling from the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation in Washington, D.C. In 1988, in the Anti-Drug Abuse Act, the Congress, in two places, as a matter of law, said that the idea of drug legalization is unacceptable and that it would constitute an unacceptable surrender in the war on drugs, in two different places in the law, at the very time that it was creating the Drug Czar's office and passing numerous anti-drug provisions. The fact that Congress found it necessary to say this in such legislation reveals how deeply afraid of the debate and these issues that the Congress is. When the Congress is voting for the Navy appropriation, there is no provision that says we shall not discuss whether or not the earth is round or flat. In the NASA appropriation, there's no forbidding of the assertion that the moon is made of green cheese. To suggest then that that alternative forms of policy are unacceptable to discuss in an act of Congress reveals how bankrupt the current policy is, that it has to be defended by law. Thomas Jefferson said that the error must be defended by the government because the truth itself will stand quite strong. in the years since 1988, I have worked and spoken about drug policy, and I find consistently that the American people understand that our current approach is a failure, and they are hungry for a solution. This conference is an extremely important step towards satisfying the hunger of the American people and people worldwide for a safe, compassionate, and intelligent response to the problem of substance abuse.
Once again, Roger Goodman.
The King County Bar Association has always been as inclusive as possible. Three words describe our MO. One is deliberate. We take our time and we look at all the facts. We are inclusive. So we invite DEA. We invite, as a matter of fact, the King County Bar Association Board of Trustees, after hearing from me and others of like mind, said, isn't there another side? We want to hear from the other side. And so we invited the local DEA office, and they declined. They declined even to make a presentation before the King County Bar Association Board of Trustees. Anyone else have an idea why the DEA didn't show up?
San Ho Tree, Institute for Policy Studies, Washington, D.C. I want to say not only are the representatives of the federal government not here, they are actually engaged in domestic covert propaganda against the American people on issues of drug policy as well as other issues now. It's expanded. It began under the Clinton administration, under the previous drug czar. About 5 years ago, General Barry McCaffrey's office was found to be working covertly with Hollywood producers to surreptitiously insert anti-drug messages in primetime television. Dan Forbes wrote some great articles in Salon about this several years ago. But this is expanded now. And the GAO just ruled this year that the Drug Czar's office was behaving illegally when it ran these marijuana ads without disclosing that they were coming from the federal government. It was propaganda against the American people. The same goes now for Department of Education and HHS, Armstrong-Williams, all these, the payola scandals. But what that means in terms of the larger issues about our republic is that if you believe what it says in the Declaration of Independence, that government derives its just powers from the consent of the governed, our policymakers, our elected representatives, are now using taxpayers' dollars to covertly manipulate the consent of the governed. We, upon who their legitimacy depends, are the subjects of their propaganda. And when that happens, we can no longer give our informed consent to these policies because our reality as we perceive it is covertly being manipulated by the state. And what that means is that eventually our public servants become our masters.
Hello, Frederik Polak from the Netherlands Drug Policy Foundation. I would like to say something about Holland. In Holland, the present government is trying to return somewhat gradually and without much open debate to a policy that's more repressive. The debate in Holland is such that if there were no international conventions fixating us on drug prohibition, it would have been changed a long time ago. There would the coffee shops and the whole cannabis production, everything would have been legal a long time ago. And if we didn't have these international conventions, what I found interesting always when I'm in the United States, that in the discussion here, nobody mentions the international conventions. They're totally irrelevant. If the United States were to decide to drop or to repeal prohibition, this would be the last concern what would happen with the international conventions. One other thing that I would like to say, I think, and that touches also upon misinformation of the American public, I think that would be an enormous gain is if the American public would be aware in some way that the situation in Holland with respect to the drug problem is actually a lot better than in the United States. I think that all of us here know this, but as far as I know, other Americans than the ones like are here, they seem to be sure that even when the United States does have a serious drug problem, they think that Holland is so depraved and the situation is far worse than in the United States. That's what the people believe. And maybe that's one of the reasons that they cling to drug prohibition. They don't seem to believe that it can be better. But if the mainstream American population would be aware that the situation in a lot of European countries, not only in Holland, but in many European countries, is really better than in the United States, that would make a difference.
You are listening to Century of Lies on the Drug Truth Network, and we're listening to a press conference held within the Exit Strategy from the War on Drugs conference up in Seattle. Next up is the former police chief of Seattle and author of the great new book, Breaking Rank, Mr. Norm Stamper.
Norm Stamper. In the mid-1990s, I was in Washington, D.C. for back-to-back drug conferences. Very different flavor. These were sponsored by the government. One of the things that all of us participants, mostly police chiefs and various others involved in law enforcement, were told right at the beginning of each of those conferences, once by Daryl Gates, who was chairing the first of those conferences, is that the issue of legalization or the ending of prohibition will not be broached. If somebody raises that topic, shut them down. And I think that mentality exists today. It's probably even stronger. My suspicion is that if reporters in this room were to ask government officials why they weren't here, given that they were, in fact, included in the thinking and extended an invitation, and what they have to say about the themes that emerge from this conference, that you would get a no comment from them as well. I think it's utterly un-American and undemocratic, but it does characterize the federal government's response to growing concerns within the community that the war on drugs has not worked.
I'm Rick Steves. I'm a travel writer, and I produce a TV series for public television in the United States about traveling in Europe. It's funny to stand up here because I'm surrounded by people who are intellectuals and law enforcement people and professionals in all of this, and I feel like I'm just the American citizen that is tired of embracing a big lie, you know. And as a parent and as a teacher and so on, I'm tired of the lie. And I would say, as a travel writer, I feel like the medieval jester. I can go out there and learn the truth, and I can bring it home, and they won't kill me. See, I don't need to be reelected. It's interesting, you don't need to be elected. See, you're a senator. I can't imagine an American senator who would believe like you, but he's got to be reelected.
Well, you know what?
I was talking with Jay Inslee, Jim McDermott about this, and he said there's probably 40 or 50 congresspeople that are as progressive as us, but they don't want to be, what was the term, swift-voted. Right? That's the scary thing. I don't care. I've probably already alienated all the ideological right-wingers that are going to take my tours, so I've taken the financial hit. Norm Stamper, you don't need to, you're retired now, right?
Yes.
From your law enforcement work, so you can say the truth because you don't need to, there's no ramifications. And I'm just tired of the lies. There are so many other people out there that just don't have the guts, let's say, politely, to tell the truth. And in our society, if we are successful and if we are free, the least we could do is have a few successful people who really have ideals to tell the truth. And as far as I'm concerned, that's a patriotic sort of thing.
Mark Hayden, I'm from the Vancouver Coastal Health Authority in Canada. The process that's happening here in this conference is mirrored quite closely by a process that's happening in Canada. I collect data and research and reports. I'd say we have about 20 years of very clear documents that have basically said drug prohibition does not work in Canada. And only recently there's been a profound shift in the debate, and the debate is now about what are the alternatives beyond that process. I live in Vancouver, the city has now unanimously adopted a paper that basically says to prevent drug problems in our city, we need to regulate the market for all currently illegal drugs. In the back of this room is one of our local heroes. We have a council that is provincial, which is called the Health Officer Council of BC, which is really the voice of public health in the province. And that group has produced a paper that basically says that in order to reduce the problems that our society experiences with drugs, we need to regulate the market for all currently illegal drugs, and starts to explore in some detail what those regulatory options start to look like. So the debate has shifted dramatically in Canada. So it's an absolute pleasure to come down here and participate in exactly the same kind of debate that's happening in Seattle here today. Thank you.
Eric Sterling from the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation. In the 1980s, I was counsel to the House Judiciary Committee, where we processed legislation to increase the ability of the federal government to seize property suspected of being involved in drug offenses. One of the things that we did in order to improve the ability of state and local governments to participate in anti-drug task forces was to allow seizures to be adopted by the federal government and turned back to state and local governments. In Virginia, for example, the proceeds of seizures were supposed to be spent in education in the state of Virginia. However, the local police would then turn the seizure over to the U.S. Department of Justice, which would then turn 80% of the proceeds back to them, and they then kept to keep the proceeds in that way. The federal government seizes in excess of $1.5 billion a year in property in connection with drug cases. The other point that I want to make is this with respect to profits. The American economy is being hurt very severely by the war on drugs. The salient fact of drug prohibition is that it creates crime. That crime requires security to be hired by all legitimate businesses. It raises the cost of insurance premiums of all legitimate businesses. That crime depresses property values in all the neighborhoods where drugs are sold. That prohibition reduces the commissions that real estate agents can earn selling property. Prohibition, by imposing 6 million felonies for drug offenses since 1986, means that an enormous potential consumer market has been taken out of the economy. When General Motors lays off 30,000 of its employees because it's not selling enough cars, someone ought to ask, how many cars would 6 million convicted drug felons have been able to buy when they can't get a job and they can't get a loan? Why should we continue to cut the throat of our economy in the name of a social program that is so counterproductive?
Once again, Roger Goodman.
We are gathered here to talk about what do we do. And so a lot of the information being conveyed today is to inform how we back out of this mess. And in general terms, what we need to do is assert, and this is from the King County Bar Association perspective, but I think there's some agreement, assert regulatory control over the substances themselves. And what that means is whether it's state-controlled or state-owned control, basically to undercut the illicit markets, so that basically taking the profit out of it. And you do that by neighborhood, for instance, with the hard drugs. You take the long-term, late-stage, chronic users, high-volume users, off the street and bring them into medical facilities and start by giving them the drugs that they want, which is what's happening in Europe and Canada now. That dries up the black market in that neighborhood and then go to the next neighborhood. The approach today is to go neighborhood by neighborhood and arrest everybody, and what that simply does is displace the problem. And similarly, we see the same sort of displacement, the sort of hydraulic, you know, it's like squeezing a balloon and it inflates somewhere else. We see the same sort of hydraulic effect internationally, where we try to clamp down on coca in Colombia, and then Bolivia, Peru, and Venezuela make up the difference. Or Colombia starts exporting high-quality heroin, which is what's happening. So on an international level and on a local level, the idea is to assert control over the substances themselves, which have now been left up to the criminal enterprises. And that means drug by drug, we determine what regulatory measures need to be taken, and we're going to be getting into that detailed discussions tomorrow about medical supervision, age restrictions, manufacturing, cultivation, storage, transportation, labeling, restrictions on advertising and promotion, all sorts of limits to access to drugs, which is what we're talking about. Right now there really are no limits to access other than the fear of fear of middle-class people of being arrested, which doesn't happen, because in fact, de facto, it's decriminalized for middle-class folks. But there are all sorts of limits to access, which actually Mark has laid out in a couple of papers. Having to be a member of a group, having to pass a test, a license that you possess that you can lose, a license that you have to earn that you can lose, needing some sort of an education, only being able to get so much, only being available at certain times. And from a regulatory system like that, there's always going to be leakage. Just like two blocks from here, we have people selling diverted pills, you know. But that is a lot easier to control than a market where the from front end to back end, it's illegal, the production and distribution. So we're talking about the black market, not the gray market, but the black market, really, to get rid of it. And again, there's going to be leakage out of a gray market system, out of a regulated system, but it would be a lot less damaging than what we have today.
Ethan Adelman, Drug Policy Alliance. Really, look at it in terms of three things. One is, what do we do essentially today, which are take various actions to roll back the war on drugs? That's happening now. Pulling back mandatory minimums, the racially unjust crack powder sentencing, harm reduction measures, what have you. That's happening here and around the country. And you saw Adam Klein, the state legislator, Nick Licata, people working on that today. The second thing you do is you push the envelope on innovative ideas, such as those being experimented with or implemented in Canada and Europe. You know, that's about heroin prescribing, it's about safer injection sites, it's about cannabis decriminalization and regulation. It's a range of things we're not talking about in the United States, but they're either talking about or doing outside. And the third thing, which is really the focus of Roger's effort here, is really to think through and to plan and debate models for how to regulate these markets ultimately rather than prohibiting them.
And one last time, wrapping up the press conference and helping to wrap up the show is Roger Goodman. Responding to a question from a reporter about whether the King County Bar Association was alone in their stance taken.
What I am doing, along with Rachel Kurtz, who's sitting behind you, we are traveling across the country and are engaging other bar associations to do the same thing. So we're working in Montpelier, Vermont, Birmingham, Alabama, Portland, Oregon, Savannah, Georgia, Washington, D.C., more and more cities across the country. And there's a lot of receptivity among the organized bar because the courts are clogged there, too. And they're over-incarcerating there, too, and don't have resources for treatment, resources to keep parks and libraries open and all of that. And so when the bar speaks, the opinion leaders and the public officials listen, and that seems to be a good formula to find the messengers, the message we all know, but it's the right messengers. So the organized bar in places like Alabama are actually going to begin speaking up about this, and we hope to see similar ameliorative changes in the law in other places around the country as well.
I'd like to thank the King County Bar Association, Roger Goodman, and all the great panelists from the Exit Strategy for the War on Drugs conference. When we stop hounding the tens of millions of drug users for drug use, we will have millions of law enforcement man-hours available each year to go after domestic abusers, rapists, people like that. When we stop the black market from charging dollars for drugs that should cost pennies, we will enable adult drug users to focus on building a life instead of finding their next fix, contact, and drug-using friend. It is possible that more adults will use drugs responsibly when we decide to end prohibition. Most certainly, the day we regulate the distribution of illegal drugs, we will destroy the worth of Osama's opium stash, we'll destroy the cartels, eliminate the reasons for which most violent street gangs exist, take away our children's easy access to drugs, basically eliminate overdose deaths, curtail the number of diseases from shared syringes, reintegrate the lives and possibilities for millions of Americans, and maybe even begin to restore respect for law enforcement. In closing, I remind you once again that there is no truth, justice, logic, scientific fact, or medical data involved in this drug war. Please do your part to help bring it to an end. Visit our website, endprohibition.org. Prohibido istak ivalesco. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Guthrie.